calling me Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name? Buried in those cheers and applause, I think not. Work. Ooh, it almost always sucks, doesn't it? Even when it starts out good, it often turns to shit. Why is that? Well, usually it's because of some asshole boss. If the job isn't all that intolerable, some jackhole comes along and makes it a daily misery. It's almost always the same reason. Boss man or boss woman has some insecurity issues and wants to throw his weight around in some fashion. It's never enough that the job gets done on time and correctly. He wants more. And such is the case with listener Rico, who has a question that may resonate, as they say, with a lot of you. Here's what Rico has to say. Hey, Larry, I'm on my second day at a new job, and the supervisor comes up to me and explains to me that I need to be, quote, hungry, unquote, for the job. It just didn't sit right with me, and as I thought about it, it sounded like he wanted me to feel desperate for the job. It's not enough anymore to just do your job well. And if you're fast at it, you can relax a bit. Now, they want you to be afraid, and you could get fired at any moment for not going above and beyond. How am I supposed to deal with this bullshit? Your fan, Rico. Oh, Rico, I could go on for years on this subject. First things first, your boss, make no mistake, is an asshole. So, if you've not begun looking for a new job yet, do so immediately, my friend. It will not get better. Part of the reason work sucks so much is so many people, especially management types, they labor under the misconception that their job actually means something. It doesn't, and very few do. There's an easy way to calibrate the importance of any job. The more words there are in the job title, the more meaningless it is. I learned that from the father of an old pal of mine. We were all recently out of school and were working entry-level jobs at large corporations. Bobby's old man asked him what his new job was, and Bobby proudly answered something like, "I am the Associate Interdepartmental Coordinator of Budget Governance." Bobby's old man sneered and said, "One word." I asked him what that meant, and he said, "Doctor, lawyer, teacher, architect." We got it, and he was right. The undersecretary of the Senate Subcommittee for Internal Zama-Zama means he or she is nobody. Of course, in our current sick fucking bureaucracy, that jerk-off job comes with a gargantuan salary and Cadillac benefits because in the bureaucracy, public service now means self-service. And private sector taxpayers are the human ATMs underwriting these worthless shitbag politicians and bureaucrats. But I digress. Most jobs really are utterly meaningless, and everyone, and I do mean everyone, is disposable and replaceable. But, Rico, pinheads like your boss have yet to learn this. They think they're actually worth their salary, and somehow they have a right, no, not a right, a holy mission to break others' balls. These clowns have been around forever, and they are called company men. They wear company logo polo shirts and company logo trucker hats and company logo watches and luggage, and they can barely have a fucking conversation without mentioning the company. Anyone foolish enough to ask them about the company will get an answer that contains the word "we" a lot, as in, "Oh yeah, we're the fastest growing Inc. 500 company in the Zimzow sector, and we this, and we that, and we, And what those fucking wee-wee idiots never realize until it's too late is that the minute the company can find somebody or even something to do their job for as little as, oh, 10% less, they'll shit-can them in a blink. I've known a lot of company men. They are insufferable. Always self-important, always blowing rah-rah smoke in your face, always boasting about how hard they work and how much they contribute to the bottom line, and almost invariably they are full of shit and work at sloping desks, where all the heavy lifting is done by subordinates. Just as there is no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in cheers and applause, there's no funnier sight than the face of a company man in an elevator holding the contents of his desk in a cardboard box as some security ape escorts him to the street. I've seen it many times, and it is hysterical. The look, that look of disbelief, of bewilderment, of fear, it's really a sight to behold. That same asshole who, maybe days or even hours earlier, was telling someone like you that you were not hungry enough for the job. Now he's the hungry one, hungry for a paycheck. So Rico, your boss is a fucking moron. And adult morons cannot be schooled. Ever. Just get the fuck away from him as fast as you can. Anyone who is productive and gives 100% for their pay should not be expected to do one more thing. If business owners want to bleed for their enterprise, that's their right. But no manager in anybody else's company has a right to expect or demand any more from an employee than an honest day's work. There is no title anywhere in corporate America that means anything except one, and that would be owner. All the rest are bullshit and replaceable in a heartbeat. Rico, what your boss does not know is that he's a dinosaur. Company men are anachronisms. Company loyalty is as passé as, what, flip phones. This is the age of the freelancer. Everyone is a hired gun and can and should sell their skills to the highest bidder. So like most of us, I've had a bunch of jobs over the years, some with some really high churn, especially during and soon after college. And one I remember well was working for a guy, his name was Alan. His business was installing sound systems in bars and restaurants and nightclubs. It didn't take a lot of skill, just availability. And the ability to run speaker wire, hang brackets, and crap like that. He had a line of shit he'd feed the owners about being an acoustical engineer. Let me tell you how that went. After I'd wire the joint up, we'd turn it on, and he'd have me stand in the four corners of the place. And if I could hear the music, which I always could, then it had been acoustically engineered. Now, whether I could hear that music clearly or not, if it was bouncing off a tin ceiling or mirrors over the bar, it mattered not. But once in a while, somebody would bitch and say it sounded muddy, or there was too much high end, or the bass buzzed, or whatever. We'd go back and have a listen, and he'd pull out some goofy little meter and turn it on, and the needle would bounce, and he'd squint and shake his head. Then he'd have me at the console and fuck with all the dials and sliders, you know, treble up and bass down and equalizers and all that horse shit. Then he'd put on his bifocals and grab a tape measure and walk around the joint measuring everything. Well, the bar owner would find this really interesting and reassuring. And then Alan would say, "Larry, please go out to the MTL. That stood for Mobile Tech Lab. The Mobile Tech Lab was a fucking Econoline van that was about as technical as a ham sandwich. He'd say, "Please go out to the MTL and get some XR247. XR247 was a number he pulled out of his ass. What it was the crap you see in any kid's garage band DIY recording studio. Acoustical foam. I'd come back in, and he'd pull out his calculator, and tape measure and carefully cut squares or rectangles or circles or ovals, and then I get on a ladder and tack them up exactly where Alan indicated. After about an hour of this theater, we'd crank up the tunes again. Alan would walk around with his eyes half closed like he was being serviced by some pointy hooker, and then he'd invite the bar owner, who was usually a borderline imbecile, to take the tour with him. And of course, the idiot owner would nod his head and smile as if there was some perceptible difference in the quality of sound, which of course there was not. None of that foam made the slightest difference. The first time Alan played that scam, I asked him about it on the ride to the next installation. The MTL had a really fancy wrap that made it look like something from a Fortune 500 fleet. Inside, it was a piece of shit with screwdrivers and hardware rolling around on the floor along with chunks of XR247. So, Alan, I'm no acoustical engineer, but that egg crate foam, come on. Now, Alan resembled a character actor from the 80s and 90s, Charles Grodin, and he spoke in sort of the same fake, measured way that Grodin did. He over-enunciated every word, the way, kind of like the way tourists do when speaking English in a foreign country. And so he answers me and says, "Larry, have you ever been to a concert at Madison Square Garden?" I indicated I had. "Well, Grace Slick of the Jefferson Airplane called it a blimp hangar. The place is an acoustical nightmare. But did you ever demand a refund because the acoustics were awful?" I had not. So one Saturday night, the Saturday before Easter Sunday, I get an urgent call from Alan saying he needs me to work tomorrow, and can I pretty please with sugar on it help him with this installation? Well, the next day was kind of a big deal because my mom was making a big dinner and family was coming in from far out of town, including my favorite uncle. But my car also needed an exhaust system, and there were other bills. I asked Alan how long he figured the job would take. 2 hours maximum. You'll be home in time for Easter lunch and dinner. I told him I had family coming in, and it was kind of a big deal. He threw some bullshit at me about making it worth my while. Had I not been 19 and inexperienced, I'd have demanded double time for a holiday pay instead of accepting his intangible bullshit assurance. I agreed to meet him the following day at the location. When I told my mom and dad, I could see the disappointment on their faces. When I said it would be a short day, they brightened, but my old man looked dubious. He knew more than I did about everything. Of course, at that time, I was pretty certain he didn't know a fucking thing about anything. It was a cold, rainy Easter morning. As I drove down deserted streets, I squinted through the windshield because the wiper blades were crumbling. I went through canyons of brick apartment buildings. It was a depressing vista. Everything was monochromatic, gray on gray. I had kind of a bad feeling in my guts, but I tamped it down. The joint was one of these faux rustic lodge-style restaurant bars, you know, fake wooden beams in the ceiling and sawdust on the floors, pub menu, heavy on wine and cheese plates. A place I would never ever set foot in by choice. Some hack carpenter had put in a small DJ booth, and they'd marked off a piece of the floor for dancing. I wondered what kind of dancing. Every part of the install was another hemorrhoid. Stuff that was usually simple was taking a long time. Some of the walls where they wanted speakers hung were fiberboard and couldn't bear the weight. The owner was, of course, home eating his Easter dinner, so Alan had to keep calling him for more instructions on this and that. It was well after noon, and the job's end was nowhere in sight. I was getting really hungry, and as if he read my mind, Alan reaches under the bar and comes up with a stale bottle of orange mixer for screwdrivers. Then he turns to one of those crappy old-timey popcorn machines, you know, the ones that have their own wheels and greasy glass panels, and he shovels some into two small striped festive paper sacks and announces in his cheery best, "Lunchtime." Now, not 20 yards down the street was a fantastic delicatessen. It was open, and the food was famous for being great. And I'm standing there, eating stale, cold, old popcorn. I was starting to really regret this day and really hate Alan. We got back to work, and I'm on a ladder drilling holes, and suddenly I hear the sound of an electrical arc, and the fucking lights go out. Alan was dicking around in the DJ booth and shorted something out. Then began a search for the breaker box. We scoured the place, every wall, the kitchen, both toilets. We could not find the goddamn thing. Finally, Alan calls the owner, and there's no answer. Probably because he's face first in an Easter ham, and I'm in his crappy lodge-style bar with a cheap fuck and a belly full of stale popcorn. Finally, the owner calls back and tells Alan the breaker box is, ta-da, in the basement, and the way to the basement is through a trapdoor in the floor of the toilet. The pull handle is just in front of the crapper. Now, of course, I get elected to go down there. It was the steepest staircase I'd ever seen, more like a ladder, really. I had to duck my head as I passed under the leaking pipes beneath the shitter. The basement's pitch black. I reach for a flashlight in my pocket and fumble and drop it before I can even turn it on. Now what? I stand there a while, hoping my eyes might adjust to the dark and maybe I could retrieve the flashlight from the floor. I knew it wasn't at my feet because it was cylindrical and I had heard it roll away. And I hear this weird squeaking sound, kind of like an old fan belt on a ventilator that needs changed. And I realize there was no power, so no ventilator fan could possibly be running. I had a few wooden matches in my shirt pocket. I lit one. The basement was a long cement corridor with puddles on the floor and mold-covered walls. Maybe 15 feet from where I stood was a huge plastic bag filled with popcorn, and several dozen rats were feasting on it. I wanted to puke. The match was about to burn my fingers. I dropped it, quickly lit another. I saw the flashlight and grabbed it, and thank God it still worked. I stamped my feet and shouted to spook the rats. At the far end of the basement, I could actually see a little daylight. I walked to it, and there was a metal door with a big rusty spring and a Yale deadbolt holding it shut. I opened the door. It was a tiny closet. Above was a metal plate embedded in the sidewalk in front of the place. That's where the daylight was coming from. Why it was there, I had no idea. I opened the breaker box and flicked the problem switch. Thudding music could be heard above. I guess Alan had continued to fiddle with the system while I was down there, and suddenly, that big steel door slams shut. Then I'm locked in. Alan cannot hear me yell for him, and even if he did, he's too much of a pussy to come down there. There was nobody walking around on the sidewalk on this dark, rainy afternoon. On the other side of the door, the rats would soon be returning to their popcorn feast. I pushed at the door as hard as I could. It would not budge. This closet thing was so small, I was able to put my back to the wall and my shoes against the door. I gave it my everything. And it blew open. I'd ripped the screws from the Yale deadbolt. When I finally made it home that evening, the table was being cleared, and my uncle was just putting on his coat. He said something about next Easter. But a few weeks before the next Easter, my uncle had passed away. The next time Alan called me for an install, I told him I'd meet him at the joint, and I never showed up. Never answered his calls either. I really wasn't planning on putting his shitty job on a resume. Some jobs just aren't worth it. And an asshole boss will always be an asshole. Hey everybody, thanks for hanging with me again here at the dojo. It's always a kick to be with you. If you like what you just heard, and you're listening through iTunes, throw us a 5-star review. It really helps grow the show. And if you really like what you heard, slide over to patreon.com/thatlarryshow and join the dojo, where all kinds of goodies await you, from signed books to special bonus episodes no one else gets to hear, and access to our deep bench of wise senseis who just may be able to help you fix whatever's bugging you. Shoot us an email at thatlarryshow@gmail.com or call us at 302-71-LARRY. Stop by the show's homepage, thatlarryshow.com, and stay a while. Be sure to click that subscribe by email button. It's free, and that way you never miss an episode. Now, for newer listeners, this show comes to you from the Take No Shit Dojo. What is it? It's an exclusive. That's right. We are not inclusive. It's an exclusive club for those who know what time it is. And what's the mission of the TNS Dojo? We're here to help you face any situation and emerge victorious, to cruise through the relentless barrage of shit-spraying ack-ack guns manned or womanned by assholes at work, school, wherever, and help you emerge unscathed and, most importantly, triumphant. Where can you find the Take No Shit Dojo? Right here, at the crossroads of madness and enlightenment. And so, my friends, as you pursue the legal tender, remember, it's not always about the money. No matter what job we do, we are trading a chunk of our irreplaceable life. Always make sure you're being adequately compensated. I'll see you next Tuesday, and until then, take no shit.